at that dove. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love, children. We could build a dream with love, oh people. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love. I got you.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
International Women's Day is Saturday, March 8th. Here at KBOO, we have more than 24 hours of radio specials planned, and we're starting early on Friday at 9 p.m. Tune in for a whole day of music, culture, and conversations by women and about women. More details about the specials are online at kboo.fm/IWD. That's KBOO's radio celebration of International Women's Day, all day Saturday, March 8th on your community connection, KBOO Portland.
Makes you such a threat.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Muchasha.
Ambetu washtelo. Oyate toka hea wichakia e machiapelo naha yuha chante washte na pechu zapielo. Le unkipiki he washtelo oyate hona umpi oholo oskate wichoni. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart and the whole world. It's a beautiful day. It's good for all of us to be here and let the people hear your voice respectfully and celebrate life. In addition to relativity, this is First Voices Radio, and I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. Our website is firstvoicesradio.org, and I want to thank you for your generosity, as always, and for being here. And you know who you are. Without you, we cannot continue, and I'm your host, Teokas and Ghost Horse, and welcome to this station, First Voices Radio, broadcasts on every day of the week, someplace in North America. And our first guest is Ross Hamilton, who is an author of several books on Native American prehistory, including The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, A Tradition of Giants and Star Mounds, Legacy of Native American Mystery, and his research specialty is The Lost and Forgotten History of North America and Her Ancient Legends that seem to revolve around a profoundly mysterious country that once dominated the landscape known for oral tradition as Turtle Island. Our second half guest will be Paulette Steves, who is an indigenous archaeologist with a focus on Pleistocene history of the Western Hemisphere, and she'll come up at the second half of the program. So with that, we will begin with Ross Hamilton, and basically I just want to say hello, Ross, from...
Hey, Joe Cassette, it's great to be with you again. It's been a while.
Yes, a long time. We've always talked about the history of North America. You know, sometimes people think it's before the native people were here, and yet there may be a mixture. We don't know, because science wants to prove it one way or the other, and then the oral tradition of the native people say it's been this way, but yet that's still up for grabs, so to speak, in a way. The Western people see it, you know, the attitude of Native people is not proven until you actually see the evidence. And I know you worked with Vine DeLoria Jr., Jake Swamp, and other people, Doug George, Ganadio of the Mohawk, and other Native peoples, and they are not here anymore except for Doug George, and we just had him on a couple weeks ago. But in a practical sense, that you have worked with these Native peoples before they left, is that you were working on, of course, the giants, the creation stories, and other modern myths that modernity has created for Native people. This time, you've always sourced Native people, the Pawnee and the Comanche, among others, to talk about this Holocene and the late Pleistocene, which is as much as 16,000 years ago, that you have thoughts about that, and can you talk about this? Because I think it's very interesting just to talk with somebody who's non-Native and what you have come up with, and just to keep putting this together as we go along in the continuum.
This has been going on, this kind of research, for a very long time, since late in the last century. And I think my working, having the opportunity and the great good luck working with Native leaders who were, as in my own language, as highly evolved as Vine DeLoria Jr. and Jake Swamp, even yourself, has made it possible for me to receive a sort of initiation into what it means to have a background as an indigenous person. I of course am not. I'm mostly Celtic from my from my flesh and blood DNA. But from the time I was a very young man, I've always been taken by Indian stories. And so although I didn't do anything about it until I was relatively mature, which was about the time you and I first met up at Jake Swamp's camp in New York, up in New York State, what I'd like to share, I think, would be something that most all Indian people who are interested in what the real truth or what the real story is concerning North American prehistory might find this enlightening, or at least very interesting. Some of the accounts that that we came up with when we started doing the work with Vine back in 1998, 1999, on very tall and very, very beautifully proportioned Native people. The reason I say that is because I want to make it very clear that the people we're talking about when we were researching so-called giants were not giants in the common sense of people nowadays, like Andre the Giant or the certain professional basketball players that have the condition of acromegaly, which is a glandular condition that causes growth to be accelerated. These people apparently had no sign of acromegaly, and yet they seem to have a basin 7 feet in height, which is over 2 meters. And this really got our attention. And my inner sources, I do a lot of meditation, just responded in such a way where I had to do this work. So we the internet was just made available to us, so we started getting into all these accounts, archaeological accounts, ancient, antique Native American accounts, things from stories that have been jotted down, things from interviews going back into the colonial period that stipulated that, yes, there were Native American people that were very tall, and no, there weren't white people, you know, European-based people that were very tall, that unless they had acromegaly. So we immediately were turned on by the idea that these people were not related to or descended from the normal human agenda that we hear from science. Anthropologists in general, and I think we'll take exception with your guest in the next half hour, but anthropologists in general like to think that we kind of evolved out of from apes over in Africa, and then eventually there were variations on human beings that worked into the current type of human being. And according to what we've uncovered from these old accounts, that wasn't the case with Native people. They seem to have been related to or descended from a group of people from the Pleistocene that were... And this is the part that has really spurred me on to want to talk to you about this, Teokasin. They were a very high moral, high-minded, gentle people that apparently were very robust and tall. But when they came here to, you know, the unglaciated regions, which is, you know, below the Great Lakes and so forth. You know, mind you, the land masses haven't changed, even though the Pleistocene lasted well over a million years. But there was a lot of ice that came down from the north. Well, according to these sources, and I'll tell you what the source is as we go along a little bit, these people came down from the north, because that was where their base camp was. That was where they wanted to remain, but that they came down from the north, and they populated many regions of the earth at one time long ago. And I know this sounds unscientific, but the fact of the matter is that when you hear Native oral testimony, and when you hear it coming from people that have been very careful to preserve it for thousands and thousands of years, you should take notice. And I did a cross-reference with other keepers of ancient wisdom from Europe, from India, and from the Mediterranean region. And there was, during the Pleistocene period, according to these ancient sources, a civilized area within the Arctic Circle that had managed in some way to stabilize the magnetic field using a peculiar, what we would call today, technology. And this place was called Hyperborea to the ancient Greeks. But Native American people remember it as a place called Chic-Chic-Alf. And that's spelled the same way it sounds, Chic-Chic-Alf. And it had a core center that was called Worsana, by the native people here, the Yurok people. And I got this from a woman who published a book back in 1916, and her English name was Lucy Thompson. The book she wrote was called To the American Indian. Again, from 1916. You can actually access it on Google Books. So anybody who wants to see the original version before it was reprinted and kind of added to by a lot of Native scholars, go ahead and get it on Google. Otherwise, buy the book, too, because it's really a very, very in-depth analysis. And she's talking about an ancient society that she was a member of that kept the history of America and the mysteries associated with this history. And I was just astonished because her group was called the American Mystery Society in English. But they had been keeping this for thousands of years in a formal sense. They had meetings and so forth. And she and her father were the last two members. And she kind of dedicated all of her knowledge to this book. So it is definitely something that you should look at out there in the audience, should you have an interest in this kind of thing. And if I have permission, Tiokasin, I'd like to just quote her a little bit.
That would be great.
Okay. She says, when the Indians first made their appearance on the Klamath River, which is in the Northwest, it was already inhabited by a white race of people. Now, these aren't white people nowadays. These are people that had light skin that is very similar to the light-skinned natives that went from coast to coast. Every major tribe, especially in the Northwest, in the Middle, and some in the Northeast, had light skin. Vine Deloria told that to me at one time. So I'm going to repeat this. When the Indians first made their appearance on the Klamath River, it was already inhabited by a white race of people known among us as the Wagas. These white people were found to inhabit the whole continent. Now, this is when the Indians first came, and Paleo-Indian sources, this is from archaeology, say that First Nations people arrived as early as 17,000 years ago. So using that as a marker, we're going to say that Lucy Thompson's people came very early, 17,000 years ago. And that was still during the Pleistocene period. The Holocene, when populations began to explode, was around 12,000 years ago. So these white people were found to inhabit the whole continent and were a highly moral and civilized race. They heartily welcomed the Indians to their country and taught us all their arts and sciences. The Indians recognized the rights of these ancient people as the first possessors of the soil, and had no difficulties, and no difficulties ever arose between the two people. And we're talking coast to coast. Their hospitality was exceedingly generous in the welfare of our people, and all prospered in peace and happiness in the pursuit of human existence. After a time, there were intermarriages between the two races, but these were never promiscuous. For a vast period of time, the two races dwelt together in peace and honored homes. Wars and quarrels, I get emotional just reading about that. Wars were unknown, and quarrels were unknown in this golden age of happiness. No depredations were ever committed upon the property of their people, as the white people ruled with beacon light of kindness, and our people still worship the hallowed places where they trod. Their morals were far superior to the white people of today. Their ideals were high and inspired our people with greatness. Now, I just want to interject here that there was a common belief that went all through North America and into Central America which we know about the first contact stories, that Native people were expecting the return of a white race who were their friends, and that when they returned, the Indians and these white people would again restore a golden age to North America. And this, again, permeated even into Central America, which we hear from the Maya and their accounts of the white people returning. They thought they were gods. And also into South America, this belief held true. But it wasn't until after the white people came, you know, from Europe for a few decades, that the Indians were sorely disappointed and began to fight them and to really disavow any belief that they were this ancient predicted white race that would come back. That always puzzled me, you know. Why did they want to honor white people so much? Because we were not good. We were bad people. And there's a few white people that were good, but they weren't enough to stem the tide of ignorance. And so we hear from Lucy Thompson that indeed there was a race. But they didn't look like the white race today either. They were more of a noble bearing. And according to what I heard from Vindaloria Jr., who got his information from Werner Muller, who was an anthropologist some time back, they were very much related to the Cro-Magnon type of people. Now, Cro-Magnon was a robust people. They oftentimes were over 6 feet, and there were some that were considerably taller than that. And they had strong jaw, the upright forehead, large orbits, very much like, but not quite as robust and good-looking as our Adena people, you know, from Ohio, who spread out into the Great South and into the middle. You know, they were among the Sioux, one of the base races that founded the Sioux populations, and also deep into the upper Northeast. And they consisted of a race of people that were so powerful and strong, these Adena, that they were oftentimes the head of their societies, and they oftentimes controlled the economies when they grouped together in larger numbers. So the Susquehanna people were apparently related to these earlier Adena people, and also when you get into the Ozark Plateau, you have those founding people who controlled the economy and were even known to the early American government. Jeffersonian people knew about them. And they were called the Osage, and they still boast members who are 6'10", 7 feet among some of their people, but they keep a low profile for the most part. Mm-hmm. And into the Deep South, you still have very tall tribal members, especially among the so-called five civilized races. Right. So these were all these races could trace their origins back to Ohio and the Adena people. And the Adena people themselves apparently were part of that mixed race that was started by the earlier native inhabitants and these pre-inhabitants that were here in the Pleistocene called the Wagas. So they spawned, if I could use that term, but they created this beautiful hybrid race that began after the Wagas disappeared, and I'm getting to that part. They spawned this beautiful kind of hybrid race that was in charge of Turtle Island, and they were really the original founders of the new Turtle Island, which is the one that we all remember, that eventually spread from the Northeast Canada and United States region across the entire North American continent, including all of Canada. That was called Turtle Island. But before that, it was like a beautiful country that was contained in the like of an ellipse, of an elliptical shape. It went from the Gulf of Mexico way up into Canada, around the Hudson Bay, and had its flanks in the region of the Lakota, Dakota people, and to the to the eastern seaboard of the current eastern North America. And this country at its height was called Manitoba. But when it began, it was called Turtle Island. And the reason is because it was found on Mackinac Island, which is at the top of Michigan. And Mackinac is still revered as a holy place by Native tribes, especially Canadian First Nations people.
Ross, I'm going to have to interrupt you here. We have a couple minutes left. So just to let you know, time flies, right?
Yeah. Well, I apologize, but one last thing. I appreciate the time. The time ends up. When these people when had lived together for many thousands of years, Lucy Thompson tells us that suddenly, in one season, all these people were contacted by some power to the north, the Great Spirit, which I think was a very well-behaved magnetic field, because somebody was controlling it better at the north. The Great Spirit ordered them all back home. And to their tearful regrets, the Wagas, these Alihana people, I call them the Alihana, they all said goodbye, they did their farewells, and they made an about-face to the north, and they walked away. Mm-hmm. And Vine Deloria commented on that. He said, nobody really knows where they went, although some speculate they went to the north and just disappeared. And then some speculate some of them went over to Europe and fought some great war for one of their spiritual leaders. But that's it in a nutshell. And then after that, only their children were left, you know, the hybrid race.
Wow.
Became the Adena.
Yes, I think we're going to have to leave it right there because it makes room for another. Well, remember this. I'll listen to this interview again, and we'll do another one to catch up on that. Where did they go? Because that seems to be in the vernacular of today's so-called new discoveries of history, that the Vikings were here and all that. Yet, what is going on? Because I think you alluded to it earlier, is that the Indians found all light-skinned people there. They came there, but where did the Indians, the native people, come from? Was that Is that still supporting the theory of Bering Strait or not?
No. She says that their people came from Chic-Chic-Al, too.
Chic-Chic-Al,
their people
yes.
came down from the Holy North.
That's right. And that's what we'll leave it at, and we'll have to go into
next time.
Next time we'll really talk about, because that's a good one to end on. But, you know, it's always interesting because, I allow you to talk because I want to find out something. And your work with Vine and Doug George and all Jake Swamp and has come to this. And, you know, over the years, it's been about 15, 20 years now we've been doing this time to time and catching up. So I'm really interested. So, yes, Ross, it's always an honor to have you here and to keep pique our interest in about what's really here before 1492.
Okay, Teoxin, thank you. Talk to you soon.
Yes, for sure, Ross. Thanks, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks. This is Teoxin with First Voices Radio. We'll be right back with our next guest, Dr. Paulette Steves.
Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs. All I ever have, redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.
And that was Bob Marley with Redemption Song, a long 1980, way back when. Over 30 years ago, my name is Teoksen Ghost Horse, and you're listening to First Voices Radio. And our next guest, Dr. Paulette Steeves, is a Cree Métis, an indigenous archaeologist who's with a focus on Pleistocene history of the Western Hemisphere. In her research, Dr. Steeves argues that indigenous peoples were present in the Western Hemisphere as early as 60,000 years ago and possibly much earlier. And she has created a database of hundreds of archaeology sites in North and South America that date from 250,000 to 12,000 before the present, which challenges a Clovis first dogma of post 12,000 years before present initial migration. And there's quite a long bio here, and one I really wanted to bring out, it's a dissertation, Decolonizing the Indigenous Histories, Pleistocene Archaeology Sites of the Western Hemisphere, is the first dissertation framed in the Indigenous Method and Theory in Anthropology within the United States. In 2011 and 12, she worked with the Denver Museum of Nature and Science to carry out studies in the Great Plains on mammoth sites, which contain evidence of human technology on the mammoth bone, thus showing that humans were present in Nebraska over 18,000 years ago. And we're going to go with that. I'd like to read the abstract here, but I think just because we need the time to talk to Dr. Steeves here is that, you know, the denial of the pre-Clovis that sites that reflects this colonial practice, buzzwords are colonial practice, which maintains an erasure of ancient indigenous presence, I would add, in the Western Hemisphere. But for many indigenous peoples, there is no separation between the past and the present. All time and all history is crucial to our culture and well-being. I'd like to start with that, Dr. Steeves, and your comments on just opening this whole important second half hour on First Voices Up.
Yeah, it's been a long journey to get here, but there's been many people that really were dedicated to this field of work long before I came into my studies. And so we really owe them a debt of gratitude for all of the work and recording of these sites that they've done, because it wasn't easy to do. People face what they call academic suicide for working on sites that they claim dated to earlier than Clovis dates or earlier than 12,000 years ago. But one of the focuses of my research, it's not just on the sites, it's on contemporary people. And so it's always on my mind, this intergenerational trauma and high rates of suicide and place that people have been brought to through genocide and colonization. And reclaiming our history and reclaiming our ancient links to the land is a part of the path of healing for Indigenous people. Part of our rights is to be able to have it acknowledged in the public, as well as teach our children about our links to the deep past on our lands, on the continents of the Western Hemisphere.
So when we think about our links in this hemisphere, you know, of course, we, as you and I know, being educated in a Western, about the West, in the Western minds, that a lot of that is this box, and in visualizing this box, there hasn't been enough room for our history, even before, you know, even after 1492, but I'm talking before 1492. That is so big, it can never fit in the box of the Western, you know, the shelving of our history, everything where it's categorized and it has to be approved in order to be allowed in. Are we still trying to make the box bigger, or are we just trying to break the box open so that everybody knows this knowledge on an equal basis?
I think we're really trying to break that box open, so that everybody can understand this knowledge. I taught last year at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and I had a couple classes that were over 300 students in each class. And one of the assignments I gave them at the end of the class was to write a paper and tell me what they knew about our history, about First Nations, Native American peoples, and Indigenous peoples of South America, but what they knew about that before they took the class and what they knew after they took the class. And I think it's, I'm still counting up their answers, but there's over 400 students that are telling me directly that what they were taught was that Columbus discovered the Americas. These are students that just got out of their secondary education. And what they were taught about Native Americans was not very much. And so what they, of course, learned in my class was a great deal more. And some students come up and thank me. Other students come up and tell me they're so angry that they weren't taught about this. So this is all knowledge that's out there that any academic teacher can take and use and share with their classes. But instead, they go to old textbooks or even recent textbooks that tell them that they're still teaching Columbus discovered the Americas. So that's really an eye-opener on how we need to really push this forward and get it into textbooks and get it into education and get it to where that students and the general public have a choice. They have a choice to expand their worldview or not. They have a choice to understand what we really know. So rather than hiding it in education, we need to bring it forward in education and allow other people those materials to understand this past and how it's been recorded, and accept it or not is up to them, but allow them that opportunity to think critically. When we hide all of this material, when we don't teach it, we're not giving them those choices.
Mm-hmm. I always think about how the structure was set up, and going through one of your favorite authors, Vine Deloria Jr., and I was looking at how through the century the intellectual horizons for more than a century have been defined by monogenesis.
Yeah.
Time is real and linear, binary thinking especially, in the stability of the solar system, the interchangeability of individuals. But I really am focused in on binary thinking since I used to be a programmer, a computer programmer. The binary thinking that's here, either you're for us or against us. I'm sure you had some students that would deny the knowledge of either or and just want to stick to their guns, so to speak, and their flag has been planted. This is the way it is. How do you approach those students of that mind?
Well, I think we really need to give students credit. I think we've come to a place in human history where students through the internet and through media resources are realizing there's a lot more out there than they ever imagined. There's a lot more knowledge out there. And we've come to a place, too, where we have these societies of people from all over the world, and they're bringing their knowledge with them, and they're sharing their knowledge, and students are really looking to that. It's like the new candy in the store. They really want that. So out of the over probably 600 students I had in those two great big classes, I only had two that showed any kind of anger for another point of view, any kind of pushback against another point of view. And that was coming from guilt. And so Vine Deloria talks about this too. There's guilt attached to colonization for contemporary people. And I start all of my classes by telling students, we're not responsible for what happened in the past. I don't want them to feel guilty. But we're responsible to learn about it. But so, for some students, that's very difficult because of their own personal background. Maybe they are linked to some to somebody that they know did a great deal of harm through colonization in the past, and it comes out as guilt and anger. So I think as an academic and as a teacher, it's up to me to frame that for the students and to help them to understand that there is a guilt for everybody. It is unsettling, but we still need to learn about it. We need to learn about the past and learn that guilt does not belong to us, that we are responsible to learn about it, of course, and hopefully change the future.
And that you talk about that moral duty, as you say, to unerase histories that academic predecessors erased through violent discursive processes of knowledge production. Also, you know, what some of the questions I had from our last interview about a year ago, the Pleistocene that created this dialogue, which we are into now about, you know, people are really wondering. Our last guest, you know, talked about another type of history that he talked with Vine Deloria, he talked with Dake Swamp, the Mohawk, and Doug George Gontineo, and the natives who are alive and were alive, and now he's come to this conclusion that there was something else here, and people wonder, especially Americans wonder where our roots came from, yet they want to know where Native people came from. Even our own people want to know where Native people came from. Can you give us a little bit of or a hint of your studies about that Pleistocene era?
Well, right now I'm working on a book chapter for a book, and my part in that book will be an article called Our Earliest Ancestors, Human and Non-Human Primates of North America. So there's a very different way in how most indigenous people think about their ancestors and that Western people do. So we, most indigenous people, have a saying, we're all related. And they have this respect and reciprocity for all clans, the winged clans, the footed clans, the rooted clans. Everything that lives on this earth is a clan, and we're all related. Western peoples do not think that way and do not consider that way and do not carry their respect that way. But so for indigenous peoples, and actually in Western science, NOVA has a very good clip online, and it's called Your Earliest Ancestors. And it starts with a Western academic guy, and it goes back through all of the Australopithecines and Neanderthals, and it goes all the way back and where they're from, and they're from Africa. And then it goes back to the primates, because this is something I ask my students, where did humans arise? Well, humans arose in Africa. Yes, that's right. From what? Primates. Where did primates arise? Africa. No, that's wrong. The oldest proto-primate in the world has been found in Montana, and over 47% of our oldest primates that led to the rise of humans are found in the badlands of Montana, Wyoming, and Saskatchewan. So where did we come from? Where did our earliest ancestors, the proto-primates, come from? They came from North America. And why is it that is not taught? I find that to be extremely interesting, that there were primates all over North America. It was during a time when they uprose 65 million years ago. They've been found in the same level as some dinosaur species. And this was a time when we had a landmass called Laurasia, which later broke apart. So there may be, I mean, they found a few older ones in land that you now call Asia, but the majority of the early proto-primates, plesiadapiforms, have been found in the Americas. So as an indigenous person, when I say all of my relations and all of my ancestors, I'm really thinking along those lines of where did we come from? Well, our earliest ancestors arose in a landmass called Laurasia that we now call North America, and they took a big walkabout and came back at some point. So where do humans come from is a different concept for Western people and for indigenous people. And I'm trying to really address that in this chapter, that there are different ways of seeing the world, of knowing the world, and of understanding how we're all related.
And yes, we are all related, but when will that consciousness arrive? I know we have to unerase the history here, but the consciousness just to have, I spoke at Yale last night and I was approached later on by an older man from the old school thought process that I walked in as a Native person on, among this panel of scholars, and I was sitting there and he honestly thought I had nothing to contribute since I was a Native person. I have long hair and my clothes aren't so well kept as the others, and I didn't wear a tie and I was in shorts and sandals, just a stereotype. But after we finished, after I finished and the panel was over, he came up directly and apologize for, because he had to take that image or that stereotypical image because of how I looked and because I was not, you know, more, I guess, college oriented dressing, that he could not, you know, even preconceive that a Native person would know what I know before 1492. And I go back when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about your work and, you know, Find a Lawyer's work, where it was all that having to do with institutionalized racism, I guess I would say. And that seems to be what's keeping the Native people and modern society at odds here. And I think that would be the question within the comment.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people, particularly students, who have realized on their own, despite of what they've been taught, that indigenous peoples are inherently very intelligent, very scientific, but the media and education has framed indigenous peoples as non-scientific because they were not doing Western science. All societies everywhere in the world have always been scientific, have always been explorers, have always learn new things and look for new medicines, and it's amazing what indigenous peoples have done, but they're not given credit for. So I think, yeah, there still is this old school group of people, but I think there's a continuum across education. And I think some of the ways we really need to address that beyond education is the general media. And the more indigenous peoples, First Nations and Native Americans that become vocal and that become known in the spotlight and known for their work, the more that people will learn. I belong to a little garden society here where I moved, and people are coming up to me and asking me things and asking me for my background, my knowledge, asking for input and asking how do they help. So people are learning to become really good allies. Mm-hmm. And they want to pass on the knowledge. They haven't been given the knowledge of our background. They don't have everything that we know. It's not taught in schools. So I think Canada is ahead in some of the universities now require all students in all courses, in all fields, to take a class on Indigenous studies, to take a class on First Nations people. And that's what's been missing. So we've been dehumanized, and Vine Delory addressed this directly in a lot of his writings. We've been dehumanized for decades. So how long does that take to turn around? How long does it take to indigenize curriculum and decolonize the academy and the general media? And I think that we need to be strongly vocal when the media is incorrect. And we need to ask media outlets like CBC Radio and others to include more content of Indigenous people. So part of our place in looking for these changes, and when does this come about? That is a really good question. We need to continue asking that, and we need to push for those changes in education and in the general media. Someone came up with a saying a little bit ago, and it was, what's the half-life of trauma? So another good question is, what is the half-life of racism? How long does this go on before the general population can be decolonized and educated? We don't know. It may take some time. It's taken over 500 years to get to the point we're at. History shows there's usually huge changes before that happens. But I see that pendulum swinging. I see a lot of students that really want to know more about Indigenous peoples. And I think it's really hard for the general public because the majority of our people are out of sight, out of mind. They're on little reservations in isolated areas, and there's a few that are in generally really good areas where they can make a viable living and do good things, and then they get mocked for doing that.
Mm.
So, yeah, there still is. We still are very dehumanized and a lot of racism in a lot of ways, but a lot of people are working to change that, and we just have to keep being very, very public. And I'm really glad to hear that you were on a panel at Yale, because the more things that we do like that, the more people that we help to educate and decolonize. But for as the amount of time, I don't think anyone knows, but I think the pendulum is now swinging the right way, that we're on the track to doing that, to creating a more decolonized society.
Glad you're optimistic about this whole thing. I'm that way too, and I think about the reference points, and someone said, where do you get your knowledge from? Where do you get your wisdom? And that, in that case, I say, well, really, it's my sources are from my people's history. It's not Greek. It's not from over there or the overseas. It's from here. And that puts them in another state of mind, that there actually is completely two different ways of thinking. And they ask me to explain the thinking. Well, it's about, I read books written by Native people, not necessarily for Native people, but for everyone, just same way as I picked up a philosophy book on, or you know, of European peoples and where they came from. I learned that knowledge too, but as you say, it's swinging the other way, you know, and I think you're part of the forefront of that discussion that needs to be heard. You know, we have a few minutes left, and I probably haven't asked the most important question, and I probably don't know what that is, but I think you may have something else to add to this whole conversation.
I think in archaeology and in education and anthropology, those fields I've been in, I see a swing too. And it's not necessarily based on, like, I am doing my work because I know that the people need this information. And I had an elder tell me in 1988 that I had this important job to do. So I do my work for the people, and that's a part of Indigenous ways of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of other people are starting to listen now, non-Indigenous people. So this is a big job, decolonizing people's minds and decolonizing education. We can't do that alone. There needs to be a lot of people working on it, and the more people that are working on it, the better. And so what I see now is I see that since I began doing my work and talking, and maybe even before that, graduate students have started to listen. So graduate students were really kind of held back from doing any research on pre-Clovis sites for a long time. It just wasn't a place you went, you didn't consider it, you didn't do it. Now they're re-looking at sites that have been denied. So that started in 2011. The Coates Hines site was redated, and it's now an accepted pre-Clovis site. And that was done by Jesse Dieter Wolf out of, I think it was Texas A&M. In 2016, the Paige Ladson site, students were diving and doing more excavations there. They redated an undisturbed level, and that site is now definitely pre-Clovis, 14,550 years. That was a student named Jesse Halligan out of Florida State University. In 2017, a student in Canada from the University of Montreal redated artifacts from Bluefish Caves. Jacques Saint-Mars had said forever that site was at least over 24,000 years old. That is the date the student got on redating material. So I think students now have, some of them have stepped out of that box, that comfort zone, and they're pushing. And they're supporting everything that I've said, everything that Vine Deloria's said, everything that everyone that ever did a pre-Clovis site has said. They're supporting that every time they do this. They're supporting our ancient links to this land. And you look now, there are sites in Latin America that date into 30s and 50,000s. And then recently, one of the sites I worked on for my dissertation was redone. There was a group of scholars working on it before I studied the artifacts and studied the site. And that came out this year, and it really caused a stir. That site is now dated to 130,000 years old. And that's the Cerreti site in Southern California near San Diego. And there's no reason that people couldn't have been here at that time. But the people that did this research that published the article, they had to be really, really well prepared to defend their work. And they did an amazing job of dating a mastodon bone that had been worked on by humans. So I think we see changes coming in many ways, and one really good way is that we see non-Indigenous people supporting now what Indigenous people say. I'm really hopeful for the future that it won't take that long to start changing people's worldviews of our past and our links to these lands and to getting that information out there so Indigenous peoples, First Nations peoples, and Native Americans can use that information in any way they choose.
Yeah, that's great. It's a great resource, or a source, rather. And I look forward to your upcoming article, Our Early Ancestors, with a subtitle I forgot. But I think that we need to keep up on this, and I look forward to interviewing you and talking with you in the future, Paulette. And yes, you're always welcome here, and I think we need to keep these eyes, ears open, and our hearts, our brains, our minds open, because it is all of us here. I think what it does is when we add Native history to the mix, it enriches it. It gives it backbone, and that's where I'll come from. That's my personal opinion, but thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me today. It was a pleasure.
And First Voices radio producer is Liz Hill of the Red Lake Ojibwe Nation. My name is Teokasen Ghost Horse, Toksha Ake Wachang Telo. See you again, surely and eventually. And we'll go out with Natural Mystic by Luca Bloom.
There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. And if you listen carefully now, you this could be the first trumpet. It might as well be the last. Many more will have to suffer. Many more will have to die. I don't tell no lie. Things are not the way they used to be. One and all have to face reality now. No one tries to find the answers to all the questions they ask. No one knows it's impossible to go on living through the past. Don't tell no lie. There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. And if you listen carefully now, you hear. This could be the first trumpet. It might as well be the last. Many more will have to suffer, and many more will have to die. I don't tell no lie. There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. Blowing, blowing through the air. Blowing. Ha ha!
tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy lunes 3 de